Ladies and gentlemen, early students of Holocaust trauma have bequeathed us the term transgenerational transmission of trauma. And that term basically has its origins in a contention that some kind of global syndrome, the survivor syndrome, is being transmitted like a wave, a radio wave, to the next generation, either in part or as a whole. Time has passed, and many papers later, we are using a similar term, intergenerational aspects of trauma, because intergenerational refers to some kind of interaction, and because, as Dr. Felsen told us, that more recent studies have not confirmed a specific syndrome, a specific clinical psychopathology for offspring of Holocaust survivors. Now, when we're talking no specific psychopathology, and this, I think the studies refer to one Columbia University study which looked at non-patient populations, we cannot exclude, however, biological syndromes, traces, some traces of trauma that are basically expected to be seen, observed in subsequent generations, which may manifest in terms of vulnerability, biological vulnerability, contextual psychological vulnerability, or a specific reaction in face of physical or psychiatric disorders. The notion of transmission is much more complicated. Here I have a slide that talks about it, that shows us the impact of parental traumatization on 2G, means, of course, second generation or offspring of survivors. And as we can see, there are different factors that might influence the outcome, the type of survivor parent, whether we're talking about the parent in hiding or in concentration camps, or a partisan fighter. The stories, were the stories told, plus stories or minus stories? Were they told in the families or were they not told? If they were told, then we are dealing with imagery and possible secondary memories, talking about false memory syndrome nowadays. Or when they were not told, then we are talking about fantasies which appear in psychotherapy in our clinical work. Non-genetic familiar transmission of traits is a concept that goes back to work by Kenneth Kendler, and that again has been developed independent of any Holocaust studies, but it is important to be mentioned here because these traits are being also transmitted and by according to the same laws in direct or indirect fashion. Of course, then there are other factors like position in the family, whether it's we're talking about the firstborn in the family or the youngest in the family. Some literature suggests that perhaps it is usually one child that bears sort of the burden of the trauma in the family. And finally here, the types of families, which Dr. Daniele described years ago, and basically have been still maintained as quite valid in the literature. I haven't seen anything that has so far basically taken on her concepts. Okay. There are additional factors which determine the outcome, and specifically mood regulation and affect is important. And here I'd like to mention work by Lori Baker at the University of Southern California, who studied twins and found that basically positive affect and negative affect, again, we're talking about normal positive and negative affect, not mood disorders, but the two are basically separate components of well-being, with positive affect being primarily environmental related influences here, and negative affect having a significant genetic component. Talking about imagery, this is how the stories of the Holocaust have influenced artists, among whom Evangelos Moustakas, a Greek artist who is the author of the sculpture Sarcophagus, the Train. And this basically shows how images are and how the stories of the Holocaust have become the origin not only of fantasies in children, but also images and then transformed in pieces of art in artists. Okay, moving on to vulnerability. We attempted a definition, which is sort of a working definition, a relative compromising of coping mechanisms in one or all psychological dimensions. And this implies that vulnerability occurs in a certain context, that individuals can be vulnerable only in certain areas and not vulnerable in others, and may even be resilient in a compensatory fashion in other areas. That biological vulnerability is very important, and that in most of these cases, in certain areas, plasticity, resiliency is compromised. Again, in certain areas. Just covering a little bit the history of vulnerability, and again, this is from before the literature on Holocaust survivors, a work from the 1970s by Lois Murphy and Alice Moriarty, a book entitled Vulnerability, Coping and Growth, that is based on studies performed in the 1950s and basically looked at children, at outcome, and try to identify certain features, characteristics, early psychological features that may predict outcome. It's an early work, and it is important to mention because it inspired other investigators. By and large, there isn't much published on vulnerability. There are some important contribution here by contributions by Susan Ross, Lawrence Cohen, and a workshop that was given a few years ago by Dr. Francis Grossman, Rosalind Moore, and David Lisak at the International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies. But basically, this is a field that is being now developed, and an important field because it is difficult to understand the hidden consequences of trauma without talking about vulnerability. And here I'd like to mention a study that was not developed or written in connection with the Holocaust, a paper in the Green Journal about 2 years ago by Braun, Barlow, and Leibovitz on generalized anxiety disorder. But the importance of the study was that they questioned whether some psychiatric disorders should be removed from the DSM-3 and just, or DSM-4 now, and be considered merely vulnerabilities. And they gave as an example generalized anxiety, which has a very high comorbidity rate and is characterized by autonomic inflexibility and thus may constitute a vulnerability to stress. Okay, now when talking about vulnerability, a very important concept is the challenge. And the challenge or challenges is a event or a set of events that basically will reveal the presence of vulnerability in an individual or a group. And without a challenge, it will be very difficult to identify vulnerable individuals. As you can see, we classified the challenges in trauma-specific or active, and trauma-non-specific and passive. And I will give you some examples based on the literature. In fact, the whole notion of vulnerability in offspring of Holocaust survivors started with a paper by Zahava Solomon in Israel. And the study looked at active or trauma-specific vulnerability. Namely, she studied Israeli soldiers who came back from the Lebanese war and who developed post-traumatic stress disorder. And what she noticed was that the ones who were children of Holocaust survivors developed more severe forms of PTSD and took longer to recover. Now, this is a study that was published in the Green Journal and years ago and is well known. But since then, more has been written on that subject. Kathleen Nader is a psychologist, formerly at UCLA. Now, she lives about 10 miles in California, from where I live. And she has done an interesting study on children, young children who were victims of a sniper attack on a playground in Los Angeles. And sure enough, the ones that came from traumatized families without having any pre-existing psychopathology had prolonged and more severe forms of PTSD. Now, in our group, myself and Stephanie Broderick from our sociology department have been looking at the passive type of challenge or trauma non-specific. This is a more complicated way of investigating, and basically in this case we are not looking at individuals who are being re-traumatized by a specific event but become victims of medical or psychiatric disorders. The natural onset, there's a certain chance that many of us, all of us perhaps, will develop some kind of psychiatric disorder in our lifetime. And what we did is we looked at the outcome and tried to compare, and we compared indeed a group of offspring of Holocaust survivors with a group of controls. Just briefly, up there is written vulnerability, and just to classify that retrospective studies will look more at active challenges, longitudinal studies are the best and would look at active and passive challenges, and comorbidity studies, the ones that we're trying to do and have been doing for a few years now, look at passive challenges. This is a slide that I presented last year and basically showed our preliminary findings, and as you can see, we can talk more about it later, but this showed a trend. The way we looked at our population was the selection criterion was the Jewish ancestry and chief complaints of anxiety and depression. That was all. We started with a large number of patients and then selected, of course, the ones that fit in our group of according to age, education, demography, and matched them with controls. And when you do this kind of work, you start usually with something like 50 charts and end up with 7 or 8, and then you have to start again and then and so on and so forth, because there are a lot of cases excluded. But when we had a limited number of cases, we found a trend of, as you can see here on the left side, children of survivors show the trend, positive trend, to show comorbidity of anxiety and depressive disorder. So what we did is, all the individuals came in with chief complaints of anxiety and depression, but a blinded rater looked at the final diagnosis. And again, these patients were seen over a number of years in our clinic, so the rater did not know anything else about the patients. But what we found is, in the end, that these patients, that among offspring of Holocaust survivors, there is a trend to show comorbidity, that two diagnoses were written at the end of the chart. And when we added more cases, we finally got significant findings. And this is quite recent, this is since last year. As you can see over here, comorbidity of anxiety and depressive disorders, 0.044. So we have a statistically significant finding. Now, we found also something interesting. Atypical depression was present, but there were four in numbers and zero. Of course, it was statistically significant, but we are not concluding based on four cases that atypical depression is something characteristic for offsprings of survivors. Here you can see the graphs. I mean, it's obvious comorbidity on the left side. You can see again comorbidity of anxiety and depressive disorders and the matched controls. Atypical depression is pretty high there, but okay. Now, when we looked at the data, and that this is interesting, as you can see, we have a group of 18 offspring and 18 controls, and reported abuse appeared in 8 controls, and reported abuse was in 9 offspring. Now, when we changed the way we asked the questions and said, well, who has had difficulties with parents? And then the same 8 controls answered yes, but now we have 16 offsprings of survivors, which is interesting because the two groups, of course, were very similar. And it also fits with the earlier findings in Schwartz and Levav's study, and what Dr. Daniele told you earlier, and Dr. Felsen, that children of survivors are known to be more compliant, perhaps conformistic, and perhaps protective about the behavior of their parents. So they will rarely report abuse, but they will be readily report the difficulties with their parents. And finally, as you can see, history of anxiety or depression in childhood, 12 versus 9, yes, this also confirms what was found in the Columbia University study. Now, just briefly, we don't have much time, but for those who are psychopharmacologists, as you can see, these are the medications that the patients came to our clinic. SSRIs, yes, they are strong and high there, 13, everybody is on Prozac or others. But what we found interestingly here, SSRI and lithium is more than twice as common as controls. And when we looked at the data, it showed that the lithium was used mainly for enhancement. It was enhancement therapy, it was booster therapy, because the diagnosis of bipolar was rare. We had only one case of bipolar among these patients. Okay, now this is just, if anyone is interested, I can talk about it later. This is medications, what kind of medications these patients were on. I had this slide last year as well, but again, we can see a trend, antidepressants and lithium on the right side, extreme right. Okay, well, this is something for clinicians, and as clinicians, we're faced very often with the, you know, objections about how we put things to patient. And of course, the English language, in the English language, you can see the Webster's Dictionary, the term vulnerability has a negative connotation, and more so for survivors and their offspring. Survivors are very sensitive to anything that might suggest the being capable of or susceptible to being wounded or hurt, open to moral attack, open to attack or assault. These are difficult things. And what we do is we inform and tell the patients that from our point of view, from a psychological point of view, we look at certain variables. Our study in vulnerabilities has nothing to do with global weakness, that people who may be vulnerable in certain areas may be stronger in others. And those are things that patients appreciate. This is a, I notice now a misspelling of the word hippocampus. God bless my secretary. But basically, this is a slide that was prepared sort of in consultation with Dr. Yehuda, who arrived here, and Dr. Sapolsky. And basically, it shows it's an older slide, but what we looked at is the what was the most common complaint in patients and children of Holocaust survivors who came in with psychopathology. Again, these are treatment-seeking patients. These are not just samples, community samples. And the most common complaint in our group, at least, was a unpredictable family environment, referring to mood. In other words, the unpredictable moods of parents. And as you can see, there may this is a hypothesis, but we feel that this also fits with object relation theory, and basically unstable environments may induce some vulnerability. And as you can see, repeated unpredictable brief states of arousals, which result from the unpredictable family environment, may trigger the mechanism via kindling. Now, in order to have kindling, you need intermittent exposure. And then there are changes in cortisol. Cortisol goes up, goes down, but it is not only cortisol, as Dr. Yehuda may tell you, that there are the receptors, and not only the glutamate, but many other elements that are involved. But the final result is the impairment or an impaired autonomic modulation. This is a slide that we show sometimes to our patients, that we are not looking at the tip of the iceberg, we're looking at the base, what is subclinical. And finally, our conclusions that vulnerability is a complex, multifactorial, and multidimensional subject. Vulnerability and resiliency are contextual. The study of biological vulnerability in traumatized groups examines acquired vulnerability, and perhaps there is a dysregulating factor. Studies have to include in vivo and in vivo challenge or in vivo challenges. And in traumatized populations, comorbidity may constitute a clinical expression of biological vulnerability. And here, this is Marc Chagall's painting, The War. It was painted in the midst of the Holocaust in 1943, and is another example of how the stories and the artist's intuition can basically generate images and memories. And I thank you for your attention.